Now I want to call to the stage to introduce our featured speaker, Jennifer Braceras, who is a member of our Board of Visitors and is a columnist, lawyer, and former member of the Civil Rights Commission, and who currently serves as director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Jennifer?
Good evening, everybody. I know my husband's in the back of the room somewhere. Can you please tell everybody to quiet down back there? It's an honor to be here tonight. When Gene called and asked if I would introduce tonight's keynote speaker, he wondered if I had known the senator when we were students at Harvard Law School. But I had to remind him, I went to a state college. I didn't even go to a lesser Ivy. Ted Cruz didn't talk to me in law school. Then I realized, of course, he was talking about Senator Cotton, not Senator Cruz. I didn't know Senator Cotton in law school. I'm significantly older than he is. But of course, like everyone in this room tonight, I'm a great admirer of his. And his resume is well known to me. He was born to a family that had lived in rural Arkansas for seven generations. He grew up on his family's cattle farm, attended Arkansas public schools. Eventually, he made his way to Harvard College, graduating in 1998 in just 3 years. At Harvard Law School, he was, of course, a proud member of the Federalist Society. After graduating from law school, he clerked for Judge Jerry Smith on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Judge Smith is here with us tonight. He practiced law with Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher here in Washington, D.C. In 2005, he enlisted in the Army, just one more junior associate willing to risk life and limb to get out of the firm. I guess he figured it was better to be shot at than toil away the rest of his life at Gibson. Excellent choice, Senator. Senator Cotton did two combat tours, one in Iraq with the 101st Airborne and one in Afghanistan, earning the Bronze Star Medal, the Combat Infantry Badge, and the Ranger Tab. After leaving the military, he continued to serve his country, first for a term in the U.S. House of Representatives, and since 2015 as the junior senator from Arkansas. Curiously, several years ago, a little-known publication called The Intercept dubbed him the most dangerous senator in America. That's right. Senator Cotton, not Senator Cruz, is the most dangerous senator in America. Why, you might ask? The article, written by a former Al Jazeera reporter, tells us that when Cotton was a college student, he was, and this is a direct quote, the type of right-wing student who loved little more than to debate and enrage liberals. Arming himself with as many factoids as possible to embarrass his hapless opponent. Sounds terrifying, doesn't it? Tom Cotton, armed with all those factoids? But what enraged the author of this article most seems to have been Senator Cotton's supposed relentless obsession with confronting Iran. You see, Senator Cotton, along with then-Congressman Mike Pompeo, was instrumental in exposing the Obama administration's secret side deals with the Islamic Republic as part of the Iran nuclear agreement. Side deals about which the administration had no intention of informing Congress or the American people. And as the article points out, Senator Cotton has led the charge on Capitol Hill to dismantle that nuclear agreement. To which I say, thank you, Senator Cotton. Senator Cotton doesn't spend all of his time obsessing about Iran. Senator Cotton makes time to stand up for American parents by, among other things, confronting Attorney General Merrick Garland about the Justice Department's plan to investigate as domestic terrorists parents who actually care about their children's education. Senator Cotton fights for consumers, sponsoring bipartisan legislation that would limit the ability of big tech to snuff out competition. And when this administration abandoned American citizens in Afghanistan, Senator Cotton turned his office into a command center, one that worked around the clock to help steer Americans on the ground to airports, to the airport, and through various checkpoints so they could come home. As his record clearly illustrates, Senator Cotton is a man who puts people before politics, a leader who is willing to stand up to the mob, and a soldier who will always defend his country and the people who fight for it. Please join me in giving a warm Veterans Day welcome to America's most dangerous senator, Tim Cotton.
Thank you all. Thank you all very much. Well, thank you very much for the warm welcome. And Jennifer, thank you for that very, very kind introduction. It's great to be back with the Federalist Society in such esteemed, august company. I think half the room is federal judges. And God willing, the other half will be soon. Now, for all you hopeful jurists out there, I have an inside tip about the easiest way to become a federal judge. Be sure your law school roommate is a future United States senator. Welcome back to Washington for the first time in 2 years. But before I go any further, I feel a land acknowledgement is called for. Tonight, we are celebrating on ancestral lands stolen from the Washington Redskins. I don't know, maybe Justice Gorsuch can do something about getting it back for them. Unfortunately, the nation's capital is run by a bunch of power-hungry busybodies who still insist on mask mandates. Of course, you can remove your mask while you're drinking, which I notice most of you are doing constantly during the cocktail hour. That's a clever anti-masking strategy. Take that, Fauci. I have to say, I'm impressed that so many of you are still awake at this late hour and blood alcohol level. I expected most of you to look like Joe Biden at a climate change conference. But let's be fair, who wouldn't fall asleep at a climate change conference? I know I would, which is probably all I have in common with Sleepy Joe. That and the fact that both of our sons like to finger paint. You know, before we go any further tonight, I also want you to join me in acknowledging the outstanding waitstaff working the dinner tonight. Obviously, working an event of this size is very hard work. We're grateful for them. I'm very sorry. You're still forced to wear those stupid masks. That's what you get when Mayor Muriel Bowser is in charge of Washington, which is just another reason Washington, D.C. will never be a state. I also want to acknowledge the Supreme Court justices with us here tonight, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Alito. And I want to especially acknowledge, even though she couldn't be here with us tonight, our newest justice who couldn't join last year, Justice Amy Coney Barrett. I was pleased when President Trump nominated Justice Barrett, and I was pleased to support her in the Senate. Even though, as some of you may recall, I actually was on the president's shortlist for that very job. I still remember when he called me right beforehand to say, "Tom, they're telling me to put you on this list, but you've got a great job. Why would you want to go work in that boring court?" And I said, "Mr. President, you can only put me on the list if you promise not to nominate me." And he said, "Tom, I'll only put you on the list if you promise not to serve." I guess the president thought that I should stick to electoral politics, given my famously warm and approachable manner. You know, it's okay that I wasn't the president's first choice for the court, but I've got to say to all of our friends at the Federalist Society, Gene, Dean, Leonard, I'm a little offended that I wasn't your first choice for tonight. I hear that I was the fifth choice for tonight. Fifth. John Roberts wasn't available. Apparently, he had a prior commitment at the American Constitution Society. Now, strangely to me, but I guess in the spirit of open debate, they invited Sheldon Whitehouse. But then he started ranting and raving about piercing the inner circle of the Illuminati or something. It's all very, very weird to me. They also asked Kamala Harris. But she said sitting in a room with 2,000 lawyers would bring back bad memories of the bar exam. Both times she took it. And this one surprised me a lot. Despite the Federalist Society's devotion to our Republican form of government, they even considered inviting true royalty. But Joe Manchin wasn't available either. So alas, you're stuck with me, I'm sorry. But I'm still grateful to be here, just as I'm grateful for what the Federalist Society has provided to so many people over the years. Learned scholarship, free inquiry, friends, and mentors. And that's not all. 9 years ago, after I spoke at another Federalist Society event, a pretty girl came up to me afterwards and gave me her phone number. And she's with us here tonight, my wife, Anna Cotton. It must have been one hell of a speech. Anna is herself a former president of her Federalist Society student chapter. So I say to all of you single appellate law nerds out there tonight, there's still hope for you. Make sure you don't miss the after party. But of course, the Federalist Society's influence and importance extends far beyond matchmaking. For almost four decades, you've defended our constitutional system of representative government with limited and separated powers. And these are not mere abstractions. They are the lifeblood of our liberty. As Justice Scalia, whom we honor tonight, was fond of saying, every banana republic has a Bill of Rights. But it's nothing more than a parchment barrier without things like free and fair elections, without separated powers, without the rule of law, and without an independent judiciary to uphold it all. Our rights, the rights of all mankind, of course, derive from the natural equality of man. That is the electric cord in the Declaration of Independence, as Abraham Lincoln put it, the father of all moral principle that binds us together as flesh of the flesh and blood of the blood, irrespective of our race or our origin or our upbringing. But the Declaration doesn't just proclaim our rights. It also contains lessons about how to preserve and protect them. Take a look at the Bill of Particulars. Our founders accused King George of interfering with elections and the operation of legislatures, representative government, abusing his power, limited government, and encroaching on the three departments of government, the separation of powers. Consider even that the Declaration speaks of God four times. Once as divine providence, and once each as lawgiver, executive, and judge. The political trinity, if you will. This is why Lincoln declared the Declaration the apple of gold, sitting inside the Constitution's frame of silver. The electric cord is both the chief end of our government and the foundational principle of its many institutions. So it's not surprising, I suppose, at a time when a tiny but vocal and powerful minority disputes these things, that the Federalist Society has come under intense attack. Few organizations, after all, have been more dedicated and effective champions of our founding principles, something America needs more than ever today. This radical minority would have us believe that America was founded on a lie, that America is rotten to its core and from its start. They would have us believe that America was founded not in 1776, or even in 1620 when the Pilgrims wrote the Mayflower Compact. Rather, they contend that our nation was founded a year earlier, in 1619, and not in liberty, but in bondage, not in equality, but in racism. Ironically, these so-called anti-racists sound like no one so much as John Calhoun, Roger Taney, and Jefferson Davis. I could start a game of who said it, and I'm confident you couldn't distinguish between quotes from Confederates like Jefferson Davis and today's woke left. But why bother? Why bother? One of these charlatans, a man named Henry Rogers, who now calls himself Ibram X. Kendi, entitled his book on American history, Stamped from the Beginning, a verbatim quote from Jefferson Davis. After last week's elections, it's dawned on a very few sane liberals, that making common cause with Jeff Davis and John Calhoun may not be a recipe for success. I have to confess I've chuckled at how CNN has covered critical race theory. It reminds me of the old joke about lawyers making weak and contradictory arguments in the alternative. He's not my dog. He didn't bite you. You kicked him first. But with critical race theory, the left says, it doesn't exist. It's not taught in schools. You're racist for trying to take it out of schools. But we still see all around us the left's assault on our institutions, which is really an assault on our Declaration and our Constitution. When they accuse America of systemic racism, what they mean most is our system of government. When they demand structural change, what they most want to change is the structure of our government. This audience is probably familiar with the left's assault on our judiciary. The left still aspires to pack the Supreme Court with all the irreversible damage that would do to the court's legitimacy and the rule of law and our Constitution. Joe Biden's commission may have thus far frowned on court packing, but it's ominous he felt the need to create it in the first place. Meanwhile, Democratic politicians openly threaten the justices if they don't reach their preferred outcomes. Chuck Schumer stood on the steps of the court just last year and screamed, "You have unleashed the whirlwind and you will pay the price." Later adding, "You won't know what hits you if you go forward with these awful decisions." Before a gun rights case, Sheldon Whitehouse warned the court that it should heal itself or be restructured. Their latest target is something called the shadow docket, which sounds terrible and nefarious, but is really nothing more than how the court handles emergency appeals and routine orders. Perhaps the left should reflect on why so many of its cases are so weak they don't even get full merits briefing and argument. And thank goodness the court issues these rulings. On 6 separate occasions, the court has intervened to stop liberal governors from shutting down worship services while they allowed businesses like strip clubs and liquor stores to remain open. But thanks to the Thomas Court, religious liberty was protected. I'm sorry, was that a slip of the tongue? Did I say the Thomas Court? I apologize. I, of course, meant the Roberts Court. Although I have to say, it was a little strange when I bumped into Justice Thomas recently, and he looked at me and very intensely said, "Look at me, Senator. Look at me. I'm the captain now." Of course, the court is far from the only institution under assault by the left. Take mine, the Senate. The progressive left loathes the Senate and condemns it as, of course, racist. How dare benighted Wyoming have as many senators as enlightened California? Pat Leahy and Bernie Sanders couldn't be reached for comment on that question. Nor, for that matter, could Delaware's own Joe Biden. This, by the way, is what DC statehood is all about, of course. The left doesn't care about congressional representation for this city. If they did, they long ago could have tried to return the city to Maryland, just as happened with Virginia in 1846. All they really want is 2 new Democratic senators in perpetuity. For some on the left, though, 2 new Democratic senators is small ball. Just last year, the Harvard Law Review published an article calling for Democrats to admit each of Washington's 127 neighborhoods as its own state. So all you editors and former editors in here tonight, hang your head in shame. And if they can't change the number of senators they want to alter the character of the Senate by eliminating the right of unlimited debate, also known as the filibuster. Strangely, they weren't singing this tune when Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell were in power. But now the progressive left wants to go for broke, using the Democrats' very tiny majorities, and I promise you, very fleeting majorities, to destroy our constitutional structures and customs and norms. The progressive left also detests that close cousin of the Senate, the Electoral College. Liberals like Dick Durbin started targeting it 20 years ago, just as the Democrats started their leftward lurch. Now a handful of Democratic-run states have adopted something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, an unconstitutional scheme to undermine the Electoral College. The current Assistant Attorney General for National Security has even published an article entitled, "The Electoral College is a National Security Threat." As Orwell said, only an intellectual could believe something so stupid. Or apparently a senior official at the Biden Department of Justice. Now, these assaults on the Senate and the Electoral College are also attacks on the states and our federalist system, which naturally the left also considers, yes, inherently racist. In recent months, the Senate has voted not once, not twice, but three times on legislation to take over election administration from all 50 states. All on the grounds that certain states are suppressing the vote, even though every election seems to set a new record for turnout. Failing in the Senate, the left has turned to the Attorney General, who has compliantly sued Georgia and Texas for the grave crime of making it easier to vote than it is in Joe Biden's Delaware or Chuck Schumer's New York. So I've said it before, I'll say it again, Merrick Garland should resign in disgrace. Thank God he's not on the Supreme Court. Maybe thank Mitch McConnell as well. Judge Garland's baseless lawsuits also undermine the rule of law, perhaps the most fundamental institution we have alongside our Constitution. The rule of law implies equality before the law, which points back to our natural equality. Yet the progressive left is willing to jettison the rule of law when it doesn't serve its policy goals or achieve its preferred social outcomes. Loan forgiveness is given to farmers, so long as they're not white. Radical, George Soros-backed prosecutors simply refuse to enforce the law at all. And as a result, they unleash crime waves in their cities. Indefinite detention for those charged merely with trespass in the January 6 riots, while violent BLM insurrectionists get off scot-free. Or Kamala Harris bails them out of jail. Now, unfortunately, the corporate media, and increasingly these days, the corporate boardroom, are aiding the progressive left in its assault on our institutions. Those who criticize or oppose the left's silly or radical ideas are often silenced or canceled. So if you say, for instance, that the Wuhan coronavirus just might, perhaps, maybe, have come from the lab in Wuhan where they research coronaviruses, I know it's crazy. Who would ever thought of such a thing? The corporate media will say you're spreading debunk lies and conspiracy theories. And the list goes on and on and on. Cowardly college administrators disinvite speakers. Amazon removes books. Social media companies deplatform conservatives while conspiring with the corporate media to suppress information about Hunter Biden that's unflattering. Although, is there any other kind? These companies, by the way, suggested it was foreign disinformation. I guess they would know, since it was the very same media that peddled the Russia collusion hoax for 4 years. Or how about Coca-Cola's woke CEO, Jim Quincy, denouncing Georgia's new election law, even though he's not an American citizen? You know what that sounds like to me? Foreign election interference. These actions can chill and suppress free speech as much as, or maybe more than, any law. But the threat from the woke capitalists extends even further into basic economic freedoms as well. Big tech conspired to shut down Parler, an upstart competitor. GoDaddy deplatformed a pro-life group. Democratic congressmen wrote to major cable companies and streaming services, urging them to stop carrying Fox News. Major Wall Street banks and investment firms are wasting your retirement savings on green energy boondoggles while divesting from oil companies and gun manufacturers. Now, I know that some of our libertarian friends might say, well, they're private companies. They have a right to conduct their business as they see fit. But what will we say when entire disfavored industries are debanked? What will we say when millions of Americans are deplatformed? When credit card companies and banks and airlines ask for your voter registration? Is that liberty? Let's not be the doctrinaire capitalists who will sell the proverbial rope that will be used to hang us. So I confess, these are challenging times. You can be fired for using the wrong pronouns. You can get kicked out of school for expressing mainstream political opinions. Apparently, you can be subjected to struggle sessions at Yale for joining the Federalist Society. I mean, for heaven's sakes, these days you can't even cheer on some poor guy named Brandon. It seems that this tiny but influential woke elite has all the power. And to borrow from their like-minded communists, they do in fact control the commanding heights of our society. The media, big tech, Hollywood, universities, government bureaucracies, and increasingly, Wall Street and big business. But those who love our country and revere her founding and honor her achievements have an even stronger redoubt, the people. And thankfully, the American people are sensible, decent, and grounded. Ours is a people who stands for the anthem and pledges allegiance to the flag, who reads the Declaration on the 4th of July, who wants schools named after our founders, who celebrate the pilgrims, who respect the police, and who still believe that the content of one's character is more important than the color of one's skin. The progressive left can mock these sensibilities. Unfortunately, they often get away with it. But sooner or later, the people have a chance to speak. And if you doubt their power, just ask the president of the New Jersey Senate. The most powerful state legislator in all of America lost last week to a truck driver who spent a grand total of $153 on his campaign. A party that condescends to truck drivers will soon lose to truck drivers. Lincoln said that in our system of government, public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. Before laws are passed, before cases are argued, public opinion is formed. And as he put it, consequently, he who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes or pronounces decisions. For four decades, the Federalist Society has gone deeper, helping to restore the principles of our Declaration and Constitution to their rightful place in our politics. The hour is late, but I would be remiss if I did not observe that we gather on this day dedicated to our brave veterans who served and sacrificed in defense of those principles. And today is a particularly notable Veterans Day. Today marks the centennial of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery. 100 years ago today, an unknown American soldier was interred on that sacred ground. Republican Congressman Hamilton Fish, himself a veteran of the Great War, authored the bill creating the memorial to an American soldier known but to God. He explained that the unknown represents no section, creed, or race, but rather typifies the soul of America. And this is as it should be. The unknowns stand in for all those who served and sacrificed the last full measure of devotion for our great nation. We do not know their race or their hometowns, but we do know the cause for which they gave not only their lives, but their very identities. That cause is noble and true. It is our cause. It is the Federalist Society's cause. And it remains today, as it was for them, a cause worth fighting for. I'm proud to join you in that fight, and may God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.